This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Like her opponents in the race to be the next mayor of Orlando, Aretha Simons says affordable housing is a big concern. Her plans for how to fix the issue, though, are a little different from her competitors. I talked to Simons about why she thinks the city needs new leadership and what she would do if she gets the job. Well, Aretha Simons, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So your opponents have highlighted a few things that they want to focus on: affordable housing, transportation, and quality of life as issues. And these are also things that you are interested in improving if you're elected. Let's start with affordable housing. What is your formula for success there?
Well, there are a lot of people who are ready and who have the capacity to build housing. They just need to have the city release either the land or the property or change zoning laws and codes so that they can build. We also need to have develop our own fund. And what I mean by that, because a lot of people get confused, you know, certain funds come from the Sadowski funds for us to have housing. Well, Orlando can develop their own fund through fundraising, through grant writing, through partnering with private and public citizens who want to put funds in to help build affordable housing.
Doesn't the city already do some of that? I mean, doesn't it not set aside some city funds for affordable housing?
Very little, because I've been a grant writer for 20 years and I've written grants for several of my clients who've gotten some of the funds from the city. The city gets a large portion and the community gets a small portion. So we want to change some of that.
Mm-hmm. How would you do that?
Just like I said, if we set up that fund, then people would definitely have to apply. We have to know that they have the capacity to do that, because a lot of people say, "Oh, I want a grant to do that. I want to do that," but they're not ready. They don't have the capacity, the means, you know, the staff to do that. So we will definitely screen them carefully and make sure that they can make this happen.
So you're saying it would be nonprofits or others who would take that city fund, those city funds, and use it to develop more affordable housing?
It could be nonprofits or private citizens, because there's a lot of realtors who are investors and who know how to get things done. So I've talked to, you know, all kinds of people from public and the private sector.
Do you think the city's doing anything right in terms of affordable housing? Because there are some projects underway right now. There's quite a few of them, in fact, and you know, people are sort of moving into some of those projects.
What they're doing right now, like working with Lift Orlando, that's right. But we're behind, and now we have to catch up, and that's why it's a crisis. And so I think the current administration, they knew all this was happening years ago while we were planning to build big buildings. You know, we need those buildings. We need the Citrus Bowl Stadium. We already have that. We need the Soccer Stadium. We need Dr. Phillips Arena. We need those. But they should have been planning for affordable housing, because they know how many people come to the city. They know how many people move to the city. So I think they could have been doing better with that.
Talk to me a little bit about where you're from in the city and some of the change you've seen there and some of the things that you might be able to do as mayor to improve the lot of folks living in where you're from in the city.
Well, I live in an area called Rock Lake. It's 1 mile from Camping World Stadium. So you may have a community that, you know, have nice homes. The homes are old, you know, like 50 years old or more. And then you have some homes that are still wooden, and you know they have front porches, and the front porches are falling in. So a lot is changing in our area. Paramore is shifting towards our area. And what I mean, they're building in Paramore and they're going to shift to our area. I told everybody, the 32805 zip code, which is where I live, will become the new downtown Orlando. But some of that is already in progress. So when I become mayor, you can't reverse some of those things. But what I can do moving forward is make sure that the people who live there, who want to stay there, are able to stay there. And the people who want to move there and have affordable housing, that we can build more affordable housing. Because there are some areas where we can rezone that people are selling, you know, like some warehouses over there. We can rezone and make that, you know, an apartment building.
How hard would it be to rezone some of that stuff?
Not at all. Laws are changed every day. That's how I'm able to vote as a woman, because a law changed and now I'm able to vote and run for mayor. So laws change every day, and we can do what we want to do. It's just a matter of if we want to do it.
Speaking of Paramore, are you concerned at all about gentrification and folks being priced out of Paramore as that area develops with the arrival of the UCF downtown campus, some of the development and the business that's going on around the UCF, you know, the soccer stadium and other things?
Well, gentrification happened a long time ago. And what I'm concerned about now is the people who still live there, which are very few, just a couple of thousand. I am concerned about them being priced out, because now, you know, the city just bought 82 houses and they're going to, you know, renovate them and they will own the land. But when they build the new projects, the prices are going to go up. So the landlords who own the houses where the people currently live, their prices are going to go up. And so, yes, they will be priced out.
Mm-hmm. What are people telling you when you go door to door and campaign?
That it's definitely time for a new voice. They're tired of seeing the same old, and, you know, we need to move career politicians out. Also, there are a lot of other things that people are concerned about, because when I go door to door, those are people who, a lot of them own their home, and so they're not concerned about affordable housing. They're concerned about, you know, pipes under the road. They're concerned about when it rains, how the stormwater gets mixed with, you know, water from the storm drains get mixed with, I hate to say, fecal matter, and their dogs are licking and getting sick. So there's so many other things that people are concerned about. And I'm happy that people allowed me to come into their home and speak to them. And we can move the city forward with a new voice.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to kind of wrap your arms around when you look at Orlando, right? I mean, it's not just what's happening in West Orlando and around Camping World Stadium and areas like that, but there's also a lot of development in East Orlando too.
Yes.
How do you see yourself being a mayor for the entire city?
Well, it's possible. I mean, I actually go to East Orlando a lot. My children go to school in Lake Nona, so I'm definitely, you know, in communication with a lot of people on the east side, and I know how much that has developed. I actually worked at the VA hospital when they first opened on the east side. So Orlando, the city of Orlando is not large in itself. You know, it's Orange County that is large. So the city population is, you know, to me, it's small, you know, compared. I've been all over the world. I've been, you know, to over 7 different countries. And so the city of Orlando is small. That's why I know we can do a lot better here.
To your point, some of the issues we're talking about may be more county problems or county issues, but you do have to work in with the county, right?
Yes.
I mean, as mayor of the city of Orlando, you'd be working pretty closely with the mayor of Orange County to
solve
some of these problems.
Yes, that's correct.
Let me ask then about transportation. What would you do to improve transportation options for the residents of Orlando?
Well, I think that the city of Orlando has not done a great job. Again, they've missed opportunities for grant funding. As a grant writer, I've seen $400 million. I tell people this all the time, that the city did not apply for, nor Orange County. Because
When you say $400 million, is that just over the course of a number of years? Or?
No. There was some grant funding that was available earlier this year. One was $200 million. There was a grant for $100 million. So there's different grants that we could have applied for.
And these are federal grants?
Federal grants. And some were for new buses that had lower emissions and, you know, just different types of things. So the city is busy. And everybody has grant writers in the office. So Osceola, Orange County, and the city work together with the transportation because we all use it. It goes to all different places.
You're talking about Lynx?
Lynx. But as far as Lynx, we can apply for more federal funding. But what I want to do as far as transportation as a whole, we're a tourist destination, right?
Sure.
So those who have 100 or more employees, they need to assist with the transportation for their employees that work in the tourism industry because they're paid the lowest wages, most of them. And so they're the ones who need the transportation. So if they could help with either providing bus credit for them, they don't have to pay the whole bus fare, but just give a bus credit, you know, so that they can pay less paying the bus fare, that would help. But we need more buses so people can get to work. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't take 3 hours to get to work, work an 8-hour job, and then ride a bus 3 hours back. That's a pretty long day for somebody who has children.
Right. So trying to improve the Lynx service would be one of your priorities.
Yes. And then I think that we can partner with Lyft and Uber too. So
some cities have already.
Exactly. And so we need to incorporate. There's a lot of things we need to do. So there's a lot of moving parts. Partner with Lyft and Uber, you know, provide bus credits for people who work in the tourism industry. Mm-hmm. And then
when you say businesses with 100 or more employees, are you talking about just the tourism industry or just any business with more than 100 employees?
Well, any business here in the city of Orlando and Orange County, too, because we all have to work together. If they have 100 more employees, that use the bus, because it's not just 100 more employees. That's not fair to them. But the ones that use the bus, and that's easy to find out.
Mm-hmm. And there have been companies that have given their employees some kind of credit. I mean, when Sunrail came along, you had Florida Hospital. What was then Florida Hospital? They were helping their employees in terms of, you know, helping them out with Sunrail passes. So something similar could work for Lynx, you think?
Exactly. Because we got, you know, our Universal, Disney, they're making billions of dollars. So that's something easy for them to do.
What about funding for Lynx? You know, one of the problems for Lynx has been a lack of a dedicated source of funding. What would you do to try and improve the lot of Lynx in terms of how it's funded?
With Lynx, what I want to do is build a grant writing team that will be the grant writers, the fundraisers, and they don't have to work for the state. They can be independent contractors, because you have to be focused on getting federal dollars. And that's, you know, one of the big sources of funding. And I know they get some federal dollars, but they've missed out on opportunities for millions more of federal dollars. So I want to do that. And then also fundraising. Mm-hmm. Lynx is very important to the city of Orlando. And I know we can bring on, you know, 100 to 300 more buses if we focus on getting funding. And when they say, oh, there is no dedicated funding, I don't know why there hasn't been all these years. That's another thing they should have been focused on, because they knew that it is a problem here in the city.
Mm-hmm. With regard to Sunrail, are you concerned about the cost of running Sunrail once that is turned over from the Florida Department of Transportation to the municipalities?
Absolutely, because the money that they have to raise, you can buy everybody in Orlando a brand new car with it.
So what would you be your strategy there?
Again, we have 18 months before this happens, before they turn it over to us. So grant writing team, also now with the whole transportation, getting the tourism tax. They're talking about raising the tax to one penny. I think we need to pass that on to the tourism industry, and, you know, specifically the hotel bed industry, to make sure that instead of the citizens being taxed, because you have people who are barely making it with a low income, why should they be taxed? And then you have people who say, well, I don't ride the bus. Mm-hmm. Why should I be taxed? So we use that transportation to help people work, and they're working to make sure Orlando is continuing to be a world-class citizens for our visitors and the people who live here. So I think we need to pass that on. Right now, there's not a law in the charter for that. But again, I say laws change every day. We got 18 months to change that charter to make it say that we're passing on that one penny to the tourism industry, where 75 million people come here rather than the, you know, a couple of million people that live here. You know, you do the math, you'll make more money.
So there's a couple of things I think you're alluding to there. One is the tourism development tax, and there have been attempts to get more of that tax revenue and spend it on things other than tourism development.
Correct.
In the past. So you're saying that could be changed.
Yes.
And then there's also the referendum. Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings has kind of pushed to raise that tax to spend on transportation. Do you support that referendum?
Right now I do not, because whenever they raise taxes, we don't know. You can do whatever you want to do with taxpayers' money. I don't know. I would like to see it in writing to say it's specifically going to be used for for transportation, because once we raise the tax, money always shifts to here or shifts to there. Oh, now we need money for this. Mm-hmm. So right now I do not support it.
Okay. Let me ask then about wages. Now, you've said that Orlando is, you know, really too much of a low-wage city or a low-wage economy. What would be your strategy to try and boost wages overall in Orlando?
I think it's about communication and with the people who can afford to raise the taxes, because not everybody weighs the wages, because not everybody can. I talked to a guy who owns a print shop. He prints T-shirts. That's where I got my T-shirts from. He said, you know, I can't afford to pay people $15 an hour.
And how big is his business?
And I get it. He just had... He had like 7 employees, but not all full time. He has a storefront. So he's doing pretty good. But he said if he had to, he would have to let some people go, and then his business.
If there was
would
some
suffer.
Kind of citywide minimum wage
if
ordinance,
if there was a statewide, if it's passed down statewide, so the ones who can, like Disney and, you know, the city government, the local government, we can do that today.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones who can't,
well, they are actually raising wages,
they,
right?
They are. They say they are in, you know, a couple of years incrementally.
So you're just saying it's not happening fast enough.
Exactly. Exactly. Because we've been fighting for this for years. Fight for $15 an hour had started, you know, years ago, over 4 years ago. So I think the ones who can, like Disney and Universal, they need to go ahead and do what they know they need to do.
Now, let's talk a little bit about policing. So one of your opponents in the race, Samuel Ings, the commissioner, wants police to be more visible in communities and wants kind of more of an emphasis on community policing. What do you think the city is doing right in terms of policing, and what would you change?
Ooh, I was a military police, so I understand where Sam is coming from. He's thinking about Commissioner Ings. He's thinking about public safety.
Mm-hmm.
And public safety is very important. But with the tension high between police and, you know, the African-American community, not trusting them, and even some, you know, other communities, oh, that's a tough one because I don't think there should be too many police in the community just riding around, because you're going to get that one bad cop that's going to be looking for something to, you know, use excessive force. And that's the thing that bothers me. But I don't want the good cops to stop doing what's right. I want to make sure that the bad cops are removed and that they are made out of an example of, so that people know that, you know, we're not just going to brush it under the rug when things happen. So having more police in the community, we need more police in certain areas. We need more police at our airports. We need more police at our schools. But just riding around in the communities, no.
Police in schools is sometimes a controversial subject too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the way that Orlando Police, their resource officers, are they doing things right in terms of how they're policing the schools they're in right now?
Well, a lot of them are. And I know one that's very good that goes to my church, and she's amazing. But I know, you know, that incident where the resource officer took a 6-year-old mm-hmm. to jail, which still makes me angry. I'm just going to be honest. It still makes me angry.
And it sounds like, I mean, the chief of police, Orlando Rolon, was he expressed concerns about that himself as well, and said there would be changes to the way resource officers carried out those kinds of interactions in the future.
Yes, he was quick to respond to that, and I do like that, and I really hope that they do. Whew, that, like I said, that still makes me, you know, really upset, because I have two small grandchildren, and mm-hmm. if that had happened to them, I don't know.
You alluded to your time as a military police officer. You're a Navy veteran as well. Do you think the city does enough for veterans?
The city does some things for veterans. I know when they started a homeless veteran program, I was a part of that, and I would go out and go downtown and talk to veterans. And, you know, there was somebody who just came to Orlando and just got off the bus, and they needed a place to stay. We can do a lot more for veterans. We can do a lot more for veterans and the homeless veterans.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, do I think they do enough? No.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do better? Yes, always.
And Florida itself is a state where a lot of folks come back to after they've gotten out of the military, and a lot of veterans start businesses. Some thoughts on how to encourage veteran-owned businesses and the like?
Yeah, I get a lot of people calling me about that, because I help a lot of business. I've helped hundreds and hundreds of business start. I've done their prepared their legal documents, 501c3s, and some for-profits. We just need to educate them on what's available, the funding that's available, make sure they get their certifications, because there are a lot of ways that they can get help, get the resources that they need. And I think having some incubators here just for veterans would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. And there's already some of that going on at UCF, for example.
Yes, there's an incubator at UCF, and they have, but it's hard to get into. They have, you know, several locations. I was in their program for 3 years. I had an office at the UCF incubator mm-hmm. Some years ago. But we can do more. That's a UCF thing. So there can be other people who start those type of businesses and have incubators for veterans and other entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've talked about term limits.
Yes.
Give me a good reason why term limits should be enforced or enacted.
Because when people stay in office too long, you get corruption. You get a lot of things that are done that they say, well, I'm going to stay so I can finish this. Come on. No, there's too much corruption to happen once people stay in office too long. They get complacent. They get, you know, above the people, because a lot of people saying, well, now I can't talk to them. When they first got in office, you know, they used to, you know, talk to us. Now I can't reach them. So I think there should definitely be a term limit, 2 or 3 term limits, a limit. That's it.
So you've given some thought to how long you would want a mayor to stay in office, or any elected official in the city of Orlando?
No more than 3 terms. No more than 3 terms. I mean, we have 2 terms for the president, but no more than 3 terms.
You ran a couple of times for city commissioner.
Yes.
You weren't successful in those 2 campaigns, but do you feel like you've got more experience behind you and a better campaign platform this time?
Absolutely. I don't think they were ready for me back then. I know they're ready for me now.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Because, first of all, it's the year of the woman. And this is, you know, this is the season. This is the year of the woman. And I'm excited. And running for city commissioner, that was a smaller platform. More people are paying attention to me now that I'm running for mayor because, mm-hmm. you know, it's a bigger seat. And I'm just not just any woman. I'm qualified. I've served our country in 2 wars. And I definitely can serve the city as their next mayor.
Aretha Simons, campaigning for Orlando mayor. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Up next, a conversation with Harry Nelson, author of the book United States of Opioids, about Orlando's response to the opioid crisis. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A new report on the opioid crisis commissioned by Orlando's Project Opioid shows the number of non-fatal overdoses coming to emergency rooms in Central Florida is up 7% this year, and overdose deaths are up 9% to 413 deaths. Still, healthcare attorney and author Harry Nelson says Central Florida is doing some things right in its approach to the opioid crisis. Nelson was in Orlando this week to speak to stakeholders in Project Opioid. Harry Nelson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you started on this path?
So I work as a healthcare lawyer with doctors and with addiction treatment providers. And over the last 15, 20 years, I just kept seeing a growing pattern of more and more disturbing things happening. I started spending more time than I could imagine on overdose crisis response, helping craft the talking points that would go to a family that had just lost a child, that would go to the staff and the residents of facilities. And I started seeing just enormous gaps in our addiction treatment system. We didn't even fund addiction treatment in this country, by and large, until the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010 and insurance coverage began in 2012. And as I was doing this work, I felt that it wasn't okay to just do it in a quiet way for the industry. It was essential to start taking some of the lessons that I had learned. I had been doing a lot of work also in pain medicine and seeing this kind of irrational policy in the U.S. where we were punishing doctors. I was defending doctors 17, 18 years ago who were charged for under-treating pain and then getting to a position where we were prosecuting doctors for treating pain. And so I felt it was critical to get a message out there, and I became passionate about trying to move the conversation forward and to try to bring some rationality to the way that we respond to this crisis that we're in.
So you were a lawyer for hospitals or for pharmaceutical companies?
Not for pharmaceutical companies. I was a lawyer for doctors, for hospitals, for residential and outpatient addiction treatment programs, for a whole host of healthcare providers, digital health companies doing telehealth. Mm-hmm. And I just was seeing the opioid crisis was touching so many parts of my work, and I just couldn't – I didn't feel that I could be involved in telling another family why they're you know, apologizing for their child being gone without trying to actually do something preventative to try to get in front of this crisis. Because my feeling was that what the work that I was doing and the response of our system was reactive, and we're in a moment where we needed to make a change and do something proactive.
What was the point at which you said, I can't do this anymore?
You know, when I realized as a lawyer, I'll tell you a little secret that a lot of lawyers that we tend to build up forms, right? You start doing, you do a certain contract. I do an employment contract for a doctor with a medical group, and I use that form over and over, and it saves me time. When I realized that I had forms for how to talk to a family that had lost a child, a form for how to talk to the staff who were traumatized by that event, when I realized that I had really literally built a kit of how to respond to an overdose, that it was happening so often that I was literally seeing these every few weeks. When I went into my third program, addiction treatment program, that had had a cluster of overdose deaths and was working on the same issues and seeing the same problems, confusion about who was a good candidate for a particular facility, seeing mishandling of discharges, seeing questions around how patients were being marketed to, I realized that these were not isolated instances that I should be dealing with one by one. I could make a good living doing that, but I didn't feel in good conscience that I could just stand by quietly while this problem was happening. And I figured if I'm one lawyer out in L.A., if I'm seeing this, how much bigger is this problem around the country? So for me, that was a moment where I just felt I needed to get out there and say something.
And what year was that?
This all started for me in the late 2000s. Mm-hmm. I was kind of paying attention to the data and seeing that overdose deaths were, you know, I was sort of a bystander to it until 2009. One of the things that I talk about in my book, The United States of Opioids, was an event that really shook me in 2009. 2009 was the year that Michael Jackson died. I was working with a number of doctors who had themselves become addicted because of the power of opioids, and many of whom were then treating addiction.
And how had those doctors become addicted? Was it the same path that a lot of folks have, where they have a surgery, they're on pain medication, and that was the way that happened?
Totally different path for most doctors who worked in hospitals. These are surgeons, anesthesiologists. They had handy access to every, you name it, Demerol, fentanyl patches. And so many of them discovered through access.
So it's like recreational use?
Well, they discovered through easy access that they could get these. I hesitate to use the word recreational because I think the only reason that a person uses a substance in the first place is because of some kind of pain. It's not necessarily a physical pain, mm-hmm. but somebody's under enormous stress. They're having some kind of, whether it's a psychosocial, spiritual pain. There's something going on in your life that leads you to use a substance. It's an escape from something. And so many of these doctors discovered that they simply couldn't be close to hospital-based drugs and trained into addiction medicine and pain medicine. So anyway, so mm-hmm. what happened was I was doing a lot of work in this in that community of doctors, and I started getting calls on celebrity overdoses, and those were happening with a scary frequency in California. And there was the one that really affected me the most was after Michael Jackson overdosed. It wasn't called an overdose, but it was an overdose. The doctors, there was a prosecution of one doctor, Conrad Murray, who had been on the scene. But there were several other doctors who had also been prescribing, and they were writing prescriptions under fake names to protect his privacy. Right, Michael Jackson was getting prescriptions under the name Peter Pan, and so several of these doctors called me, and they were in a panic. They realized they had done something wrong, but they were now afraid that they were going to lose their licenses and be going to jail. And I did what I always do, which is to try to calm people down and get them to take a rational approach and figure out a strategy to acknowledge what they had done and try to hold on to whatever they could hold on to. And so one of the doctors, and I write about this in the book. He seemed to calm down, and we scheduled an appointment for the next day. And when he didn't show up, I called the office, and I found out that he had himself overdosed. Hmm. And that shook me, and I realized that there's this. It's not just these overdoses weren't isolated events. There is just a culture, and a widespread. They had become so prolific that I needed to do something. That was a moment that disturbed me. I've been haunted by situations like that. But over it really began for me then, and over the last 10 years, I started speaking out more. Originally, just talking to other lawyers, and that led to getting some attention from some of the federal and state agencies addressing the problem, being invited and getting a seat at the table. And then the more that I sat at the table with senior policy leaders in this country, the more I realized that there were some parts of this crisis that nobody really wants to talk about, and that led me to write my book.
What's the response been to your book so far?
The response has been terrific. There's a change in the level of public awareness. But one of the things that bothered me was that it's on the new opioids are on the news every few days, right? There's another celebrity overdose, the Tyler Skaggs, the California Angels pitcher, was the last one a couple months ago that got a lot of attention.
But don't you think, though, aside from the celebrity overdoses, which get a lot of attention, there's also more of a focus on what is this doing to folks with just regular jobs?
So you see coverage of just the widespread overdoses in these hot zones in West Virginia, in Southern Ohio, mm-hmm. in New England. And you also see the opioid litigation, right, has attracted a lot of attention. Everybody's
right.
watching to see how much money is going to be paid out. So there's clearly more attention, but what I noticed, the feedback that I got from the book was, people still don't really understand the problem, what's really going on here, and how we're going to solve it. There have been some great books written about the opioid crisis in the last few years. My goal was to add something that added some historical color, some nuance, so that we would see this sort of how this fit within American healthcare, and then also to add the message that I've come away with over the last few years, which is that we're not going to solve this problem just with a new drug or a new approach in healthcare. We need to really look broadly at how we can leverage, you know, all the aspects of our society that play into this crisis, right? And how can we bring our schools? How can we bring our workplaces? How can we bring our civic communities and faith communities into the work of addressing this? Because this problem is a deep, profound one that doesn't have an easy solution. It's going to be a long-term effort. Mm-hmm. So the response to the book has been fantastic. It's led to a lot of valuable conversations, and then hopefully to work that's just beginning.
What's your message to Central Florida? Because I'm wondering if when you travel around the country, you talk about your book, do you say the same thing to every community, or is every community slightly unique in its response to the opioid crisis? Or are there certain messages that you can basically tell every community and give them some advice on how to move through this and how to move forward?
I think there's a lot of variation in what the problem looks like and in how far communities have moved towards thinking about a solution, right? So you can certainly see the problem. There are parts of the country where the problem looks worse than Central Florida. If you've been to West Virginia or Southern Ohio, if you go to visit Native American tribes in New Mexico, as I have done, you see some pretty horrific hot zones where this is just unimaginable. And then you see wealthy communities where it looks really – it looks different. But the problem is still there. Central Florida is definitely it's important. I think it's important to take a regional approach. And I think the most interesting thing to me about Central Florida is not so much on the problem. The numbers that I see coming out of Central Florida are consistent with the numbers nationally on all of these issues in terms of overdose deaths, in terms of the numbers of people with addictive disorders. But what really has struck me, and the reason I'm excited to be here this weekend, is that thanks to Project Opioid, which is the reason I came out, there's incredible data on Central Florida that is really distinctive from the rest of the country. Meaning, in most of the country, we have really not dug into the numbers at a local level. And so we're not in a position to have a coordinated response. So what's been a thrill for me here has been in the last few weeks and months to start looking at data from Central Florida from the University of Central Florida and from the researchers connected to Project Opioid, and to be able to actually see a microcosm of what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you see that the prescription opioid problem in Central Florida is worse than in some places, that there may heroin trafficking may not be as big a problem in Central Florida as it is, for example, in some of the big cities on the East Coast. So there are differences here, and what's really encouraging to me is that I think Central Florida has actually taken a lead nationally by organizing the data, by beginning to put together a coordinated response. And I think that's a model that other communities are going to learn from.
Are you working on a follow-up to your book?
I've started working on a broader project. You know, one of the things that interests me, the hardest problem for me is the pain problem, mm-hmm. right? I think that we, with Narcan, with medication-assisted treatment, we can bring the overdose death toll down in the coming years. But the problems, the bigger problems are, how do we actually get to effective addiction treatment, and how do we deal with this pain crisis? So I'm really interested in what we could be doing differently on a preventive level for stress-related disorders. You know, I have four kids, and I watch them with the smartphones, and I worry a lot about the level of stress, anxiety, depression that I see everywhere around, and that I find myself experiencing. And I think we're living in a challenging time. And so my next project that I'm just starting to work on is how can we actually integrate into our system a broader understanding of stress-related disorders that are sort of a step before we get to pain and to addiction, and can we do things to actually bring the numbers down? It's early on that, and still doing plenty of work on the opioids.
Well, Harry Nelson is the author of The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Still to come, Opera Orlando launches its season with a new twist on Marriage of Figaro, bringing Mozart's opera into the 20th century and drawing inspiration from Downton Abbey. That conversation after the break. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Opera Orlando launches its season with a new twist on Marriage of Figaro, bringing Mozart's opera into the 20th century and drawing inspiration from Downton Abbey. I spoke with the opera company's executive and artistic director, Gabe Pricer, who performs as Figaro, soprano Brittany Robinson, who's performing the role of the Countess, and stage director Bob New. Pricer began by talking about the opera company's move next year into the brand new Steinmetz Hall at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts.
So The Marriage of Figaro opens this weekend, November 1st through the 5th. We're at the Pew Theater, very intimate, with the chamber orchestra provided by the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra. And next season, we'll make the big move into Steinmetz Hall, which will be 1,500 seats, great size for opera, a real acoustic space. Mm-hmm. And luckily, everything got worked out with Dr. Phillips Center for that.
And things are looking a little bit precarious in terms of not just the opera, but the other artistic organizations that were going to be the tenants of Steinmetz Hall. Just walk us back for our listeners. What was going on?
Sure. So the primary users of Steinmetz Hall will be the ballet, the Philharmonic, and the opera. And that's really what the space was being built for, an acoustic space for classical music, for live classical music without microphones. Opera Orlando was kind of the odd man out because we weren't receiving the resident rate mm-hmm. that the ballet and the Phil were receiving. And even with that resident rate, it was higher than what the Phil and the ballet could afford.
And just to clarify, so resident rate would be you would be performing there more often, therefore you'd get a discount?
Right. It kind of goes back to the agreement that Dr. Phillips Center had made with the city that it would use city funds to build a home for, mm-hmm. at that time, the Orlando Opera, the Orlando Ballet, and Orlando Phil. And in the contract with the city, it said, or any of its successors. So there was debate about whether Opera Orlando was a successor, and everyone has different opinions about that. But kind of long story short, what happened was Dr. Phillips Center changed their approach to the entire idea of resident status and said, well, we'll just give the discounted rate to all nonprofits. And mm-hmm. they're calling it an arts for everyday life rate or for every life rate, which is great. So it puts us all on the same terms, on the same playing field. And while it would be great if other arts groups can use Steinmetz Hall, that will be wonderful. I still think the primary users will be the ballet, the Phil, and the opera, and we're mm-hmm. all much happier with the discounted rate that Dr. Phillips Center is offering. We're still going to need to work hard to raise money. That's always part of being a nonprofit, and also work hard at selling tickets so we can sell out our first performance at Steinmetz Hall.
What is the space going to look like?
Well, it's an adaptable space, so it depends on the configuration. There is an orchestra configuration and an opera configuration. The orchestra, the seats will wrap around. Opera, obviously, we don't want those seats to wrap around because we want to have our set and fly in set pieces. So the opera configuration will be more traditional Italian opera house, the horseshoe shape with the full pit orchestra, which we're very excited about because we don't have a pit right now in the Pew Theater. We stuffed the orchestra into the box seats, which works great. You'll still love it if you're coming this weekend. And also have a full fly system, a lot more wing space than we currently have at the Pew Theater.
What's a fly system?
That's what comes from above. So you'll fly in these drops or set pieces. You fly them down and you can pull them back out. Just makes those transitions. We can, as opposed to having a unit set, we can create more looks for the different scenes or different acts of an opera. Also, the audience, as you know, the Disney Theater is more horizontal. But to create that natural acoustic, it's going to be more of a vertical space with more balconies. And again, it's only 1,500 seats, whereas Disney Theater at Dr. Phillips Center is 2,700 seats. So it's going to still feel pretty intimate, which is wonderful. It's a good size for us.
Right. Brittany, talk to me about the importance of performing in a space like Steinmetz Hall will be for you, for a soprano. What's it like kind of anticipating that new hall?
Oh, it will be great. I feel like as a singer, having these acoustical spaces, especially as Gabe was saying, the more vertical spaces, it just helps bring out the essence of the performers, the singers, the opera singers' tones much better, as well as it helps us to, you know, make sure that we're able to balance everything correctly between the orchestra as well as what we're hearing. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's based off of course our singing, our classical technique that we have, but being able to be in acoustical space, to sing in this space and be able to actually really play around with the sounds and what we can do, of course, then is able to have the audience, the listeners, be able to enjoy it even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're not using amplification, so you're projecting your voice.
Exactly. No mics whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Unless, I mean, there's been in some cases I've used mics in these halls, and it's because we've had dialogue, you know, English dialogue or German or Italian, whatever dialogue it is, we have to speak. But when it comes to actually singing, no mics whatsoever.
What's your favorite hall to perform at?
Oh, that just put me right on the spot.
What about the one you just sang at?
I know. As Gabe was saying, I just finished singing actually at the Metropolitan Opera. And so that hall in itself, of course, with no mics, was absolutely stunning and so great. Just to, you honestly could sing the quietest note ever and still be able to, you know, resonate. Mm-hmm. But I've also been in wonderful halls, of course, abroad that are much smaller, as Gabe was saying, not like the 22 or seating like 3,000 seats, but the ones abroad that are very intimate, like 13,000 or 3,000 seats. And, you know, it's covered in gold and velvet and everything, but acoustically it's absolutely amazing because, again, it brings you that intimate setting. I've been in plenty of different theaters that have always, you know, influenced something. I mean, even the Pew, the first time I actually stepped on there, even though it may not be acoustically set up for opera, still stepping on stage, it's still beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Very beautiful, very intimate. But, like, I remember taking actually a picture of it, and the ceiling itself is just stunning. It's in this very kind of avant-garde, new age that many people actually necessarily, you would not think that that would be there.
All right, so, Bob, tell me about this performance of Marriage of Figaro. What approach are you taking to this?
Well, we're updating this, and we're setting this piece in 1910 England, a la Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a piece that's all about the relationship between the servant class and the ruling class. And certainly that's the same thing as Downton Abbey. I like to update operas as much as I can so that they seem to be contemporary to audiences so they can relate. And this was a time in world history, where the upper class, lower class had exactly the same relationship that Mozart depicts.
Do you feel like people have enough kind of understanding of that relationship? You know, America is obviously a slightly different society from England. People might have watched Downton Abbey, but do you have to do a little bit of explaining, at least kind of visually, what's going on to cue people in?
I mean, I think a little bit. I think, again, Mozart draws these characters so well that I don't know if it needs a lot of explaining. He's a wonderful storyteller in De Ponte, his librettist, so that I don't think this is something where audiences will go, wait, what is this relationship going on? From the very first scene where we see Figaro measuring his room to see if his bed is going to fit, his wedding bed that the Count has given him, we understand kind of what the start of this relationship is.
Mm-hmm. So how many iterations of Marriage of Figaro have you put on?
This is the fifth time I've directed the show.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, yeah.
And has your approach to it changed over the years?
Well, it has in that, you know, it's a fairly complex story. It has a lot of layers. The characters are very complex. So with each iteration, I hope and I feel like I found better ways to tell the story, to help the audience to be let into this world. So, yeah, I mean, it always changes. And, of course, the performers that you're working with, they influence you greatly. This is a cast of really imaginative, wonderful, great people who mm-hmm. have ideas. And, you know, and you listen to those ideas as a director and you work with that.
Do you feel like there's this – do you feel like you have a responsibility to try and, where you can, make it accessible for new audiences? And I kind of wonder if, you know, the idea of bringing in some pop culture, like references like Downton Abbey, for example, that helps get new people into opera.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we absolutely have that obligation to make it friendly for audiences. You know, there's this weird idea that some people still have that opera is, you know, for rich people and that you have to wear a tuxedo and a ball gown to attend and that it's just not accessible to the general public. And that's, of course, ridiculous. It started out as entertainment for mm-hmm. the general public. So, yes, I feel very much that we have that obligation, both in the way we present things, but also in the way that we as artists and performers think about them. We have to think of ourselves as being accessible to people and not something that, you know, that's so special and unique that it's unobtainable.
People in Florida, though, tend to just wear flip-flops and shorts wherever they go.
Great. Great.
Are you expecting to see some tuxes in the audience this weekend?
I don't have any preconceived notion. I actually don't even notice that. I mean, I don't care mm-hmm. myself. I don't care. As long as they don't get arrested for anything, I'm perfectly fine with
that. That would make it interesting.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
So what are you looking forward to about this performance, Brittany?
Oh, wow. So this is actually a role debut. I've never actually played the Countess before. Back in college days, I remember doing a lot of scenes, playing Susanna, and I've done a lot of other Mozart operas, playing the leading ladies. But The Marriage of Figaro was never one of them. So when I got the call from Gabe, I was like, yeah, let's do this. I kind of feel like I'm going in this right direction, and it's something to help build onto what I already have, let alone also build into this new character. Mm-hmm. I've always, I maybe call me weird, I'm a weird soprano, I've always enjoyed singing Mozart. I don't know why, like how that all works. Honestly, I've always enjoyed any type of Mozart, classical, even Baroque. I grew up on Baroque. Mm-hmm. But being able to sing the Countess is, especially in this Downton Abbey, because I'm a huge Downton Abbey fan. So when I found out it was Downton Abbey, I was like, oh, Lady Grantham, Maggie Smith. Like, I have all these things to pull from. And so just to be able to do this character and pull from all the, you know, these different layers and kind of add this next level, this character into the repertoire is absolutely amazing. I'm really mm-hmm. excited. Yeah.
Gabe, what else is coming up for Opera Orlando the season ahead?
Yeah, so this is the start of our Opera on the Main Stage series, but we also have our Opera on the Town series, which continues with A Mall and the Night Visitors, and we have free performances for kids throughout the community from Tarpon Springs all the way to New Smyrna Beach, right in time for the holidays. That's a great holiday piece. Only 45 minutes in English. I mean, come on. What's not to love about that? We're also our next main stage production is All is Calm, and it's the Florida premiere of this work about the Christmas truce of World War I. It's a very powerful, poignant piece. And what's cool about it, we're doing it in the round in the Pew Theater, and it's a cappella. So the audience will feel like they're in the trenches with those soldiers as they read the actual words of letters from the soldiers that they wrote about this experience, and they sing the actual songs that were sung in the trenches that fateful evening. Hmm. And then we head over to Cheyenne Saloon in February. I know last time we talked, we discussed having to change our venue around.
Because part of that's going to get demolished.
Yeah, so they're unfortunately tearing down the Orchid Garden Room, but they're keeping Cheyenne Saloon, thank goodness. We originally were going to do Flatermouse in the Orchid Garden Room, but since they're tearing that down, we went back to the drawing board, as it were, and we're going to be doing The Girl of the Golden West, Puccini's cowboy opera, which is set in a saloon. So we'll be presenting that at Cheyenne Saloon.
So it's like the original spaghetti western?
It totally. Yeah, I mean, it was either that opera or all those western movies being made by Italian film producers that we got the phrase spaghetti western. So mm-hmm. yeah, come see a real spaghetti western in downtown Orlando in February.
Well, Gabriel Prosser is the executive and artistic director of Opera Orlando. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt, for having us.
We're also joined by Brittany Robinson. She's a soprano with Opera Orlando. Brittany, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Bob New is the stage director for The Marriage of Figaro. Bob, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. We can only produce programs like Intersection and do the kind of local reporting you hear on Spotlight, Are We There Yet, or during All Things Considered and Morning Edition with your help. If you've already made a contribution to our fall silent drive, thanks. If not, call 1-800-785-2020 or go to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.